I get so lucky? Like, you know how I got lucky? Because I trusted what I knew in my gut, which was it didn't matter that I didn't have a college degree. It didn't matter that I wasn't a PhD. Was I ashamed of those things early on? A little, but I was like, you know what? That doesn't mean I don't have like some kind of innate intelligence that maybe they don't have. Maybe my intelligence is intuitive. Maybe the mystical sort of spirit connection I have to books is enough to help propel people's destiny. And I just freaking trusted. And I'm so glad that I'm naive and grandiose enough to have done that because it's worked out.
Welcome to About Your Mother. This is your host, Jennifer Griffith. The definition of a fairy is a mythical being of folklore, usually having magic powers and dwelling on Earth. I call Linda Severtson an agent fairy. She calls herself the Book Mama. She's authored and co-authored 11 books, 2 New York Times bestsellers. She's any writer's best coach, an agent connector, and host of the Beautiful Writers podcast, where you can listen to the greats talk about their craft. Liz, Glennon, Deepak, Cheryl, Terry, Dean, you get the idea, the big ones. She has interviewed countless New York Times bestselling authors and has found the recipe to the secret sauce of making it as a writer, which, if you ask me, is the recipe to achieving any creative dream. Enjoy the listen.
Linda, welcome to About Your Mother.
I'm so happy to be here, beautiful.
I'm so happy to have you. And like I said earlier when we were catching up, this podcast was born at your writing retreat. So isn't this a full circle moment?
And I had no memory of that. I mean, once you started talking, I remembered, but wow, magic.
Well, you're a busy girl. So no, if you don't remember, that's okay. Well, welcome to the show because you're
you guys. There's like 400 of you guys. I feel like I have like love umbilical cords all over the world with you guys. And I try to keep up and social media is magic for following, but I do forget sometimes how things are born.
You do. You have 400 babies. Good for you. And you also have a new baby. Beautiful Writers, your book. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Girlfriend, it's good. It is, like I was saying earlier, it is like curriculum to have this book beside you as you're going through every step of the writing publishing process. It's just that good.
Thank you, babe.
You have an incredible journey as a writer and a teacher and a dream maker. Can we start from the beginning, how you started as a badass dog walker and then launched this incredible journey for yourself? Can we start there?
Yes. You know, dog walking was a dream job for me, just an absolute dream. It was mindless. I could be out in the sun and exercising and getting paid to like kiss dogs. Are you kidding me? And it just so happened that I was in Beverly Hills in Hollywood in the most beautiful neighborhoods with just so much foliage and beautiful houses to look at. Anyway, it was a great job. And I think the reason I was so successful at it was it didn't matter who the celebrity owners were. What mattered to me were the animals. And I was so obsessed with the animals and the day-to-day just doing of the job that it kind of endeared me to them, right? I think they trusted me.
Yeah.
And so then when I had a dream, year like 5 years in, that told me to interview the people I was walking dogs for about the sort of behind the scenes reality show before there was such a thing, details of their lives, I trusted it. And I just started interviewing people, so random, but it really worked. It worked out beautifully. It was kind of a magical beginning to my career.
And a lot of your career is spiritual based, meaning there's callings and there's mentors along the way. I think that's a really important thing to remember as a writer, is that it is originally a calling. And half the time you don't know how to do it.
As a kid, I wanted to be a writer desperately. Yeah. And I was raised with bookworm parents and we had a little library in our home and I was just obsessed with books. And I didn't feel smart enough. My sister was a brainiac, you know, kind of photographic memory type of person, as was my mother. And I was like the fun athletic girl. I was not a bookworm. And so I just kind of shelved that dream thinking, well, probably not going to happen for me. And so to have the calling come forth in a dream was so magical and so mystical. And that was one of my favorite chapters of the book to write, because it really hit me like a bolt of lightning and I never looked back.
Mm-hmm. You just followed it. And talk about your mother. She did influence you greatly, didn't she? Your father too. But tell us about your mother.
Yeah, my mom was so brilliant and so fiercely protective of both her daughters and the environment. So I was raised really with an awareness of global warming as a kid. I was raised with an obsession of falling water tables and climbing temperatures. And so when I had the dream to become an author, she was still alive for a while. She never saw it get published. But part of what drove me was that I thought, well, I can interview environmental celebrities, people in the trenches who are doing this like heroic work to save our natural world that the press doesn't give two shits about, honestly. At the time, nobody seemed to care. And certainly readers didn't seem to care. And I thought, well, if I combine those environmental details with like the tabloid-esque tales that these celebrities are telling me about being incested by the royal family and being bulimic and overcoming drug addiction and whatever, if I combine their heroic work with the environment with those stories, they'll be educated through the back door and actually maybe care, and maybe we can make a difference. And so I was so motivated by my mother's life and then by her death to continue the work that she never felt like she had fully realized in her life.
But it inspired you to do it.
100%. And
you getting some of these interviews is, I feel for you, because I had been in sales before, but you know, getting that meeting, the one with Woody Harrelson was hysterical, but the one that really sat with me was the one with Seal. That is so well written.
Thank you.
I was zipped in your skin and feeling all the awkwardness.
So embarrassing, right? So embarrassing. And, you know, I wanted to write a book for creatives about what it's really like behind the scenes, because so often we see these, you know, legends in the world, the Anne Lamotts and the Liz Gilberts and the Dean Koontz and Tom Hanks. And we don't understand how many face plants they actually had and how hard it was for them to get an agent or the crazy things that they did. We don't really see enough of those stories. And I knew from having them on the podcast that they had those stories, but I also knew that my stories were so absurd and so sort of cinematic as well. I thought, well, if I write mine and then add theirs in, that could be really good. But I was a little scared to tell some of them. Like, the Woody Harrelson story, that it's absurd. And the Seal story, you know, just to give the listeners a little bit of an idea, I am struggling throughout my story. It's a writing memoir. So I'm struggling throughout the memoir to get published for the first time. I've had the dream about this great book that I'm supposed to write. Yeah. And I'm super committed and I'm showing up every day. And yet my agent, when I get one, keeps saying, Linda, you need one more celebrity, one more big name, because who am I? I don't have a radio show. I don't have a TV show. I'm not famous. I don't have any platform to speak of. So for him to sell the book, he needed me to have more star power from other people. Mm-hmm. And so you see me consistently trying to get these big names involved, and the stuff that I'm willing to go through and the magical synchronicities that happen, it's very much like a crazy blueprint for success and manifestation. So Seal, I am convinced, is going to be in the book. I need him to be in the book. I'm obsessed with his music.
He's your golden ticket.
My golden ticket. And I visualize him throughout the storyline. You see me doing these funny things, these visualizations. One day, wouldn't you know it, one of my girlfriends starts dating him. Amazing. Brings him out to the forest where I live, like freaking going on safari. I live off the grid in New Mexico, in the middle of nowhere. And Seal comes to dinner. And it is the biggest shit show, literally shit show, that you could imagine. And it was I was butt laughing writing that chapter. And people said to me, they were like, how can you admit this stuff? It's so devastating. I'm like, are you kidding? This is the gold. This is it. It's the biggest gift in the world to have something so disastrous happen that then you can tell a story and laugh about it. I mean, had to do it.
Let's talk on this because you teach this a lot to your writers. That's the gold, the uncomfortable, the awkward, the shame. Yeah. That is what people gravitate towards. I know it sounds a little sick, but it's true. They want to read it,
I'm
right?
I'm never embarrassed. I'm an open book when it comes to this, the craziness I have done. Because first of all, that whole quote, fortune favors the bold.
Yeah.
I really think it's in those crazy times that we put ourselves out there and we're grandiose and we're pie in the sky and we don't know what the heck we're doing. And we fling ourselves and our enthusiasm and our bad punctuation out into the universe. And so much goofy crap comes back. But also, I think there are, it's as if the muse or God or whatever looks at those attempts and says, bless you. Holy moly, bless you.
Bless your heart.
Bless your heart. Let me throw you a bone.
And this is amazing too. I mean, you have the greats in here. Everyone from Tom Hanks to Elizabeth Gilbert. Every single person has struggled.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, we're all just, my sister is a Vedic astrologer and she always makes me feel so much better when I'm feeling forsaken by the universe. She goes, Linda, this universe is not the place you want to come if you want an easy life. She's like, 7 of the 9 planets are malefic. So, and I don't know if she was including Rahu and Ketu, which are nodes of the moon, but in Vedic astrology, they count. But she said in the Vedic system, the only positive planets, and that doesn't mean good things don't come from all the influences, but the only truly like benefic planets are the moon and Venus.
Wow.
Everything else kicks your ass. So it's like, yeah, if you're in a 19-year Saturn period, which I was in, where my mother died, my father died, my husband left me, my kid was suicidal, like sure felt like a Saturn period when you learn about that stuff. So we're all just doing our best. Nobody gets an easy path. Nobody
gets an easy path, even though some make it look easy, right? Or it seems that it was easy for them.
People sometimes tell me I make it look easy. You know, people will say to me, I remember when I was going through my divorce and I had to ask my friends for money so I didn't lose my house. And I paid them all back with interest, but I had to go begging. And people were like, I never would have thought to offer because you look like you've got it all together. Mm. And it's like, nope.
No. And it's so much more fun when we admit we don't have it all together, right? So a lot of writing too, and what I think you coach people on, is letting go of the fear. And there's a couple of things that I think the fear come from. One is how freaking long this takes.
Yeah.
Time is a chapter for you. So you want to talk about that, like what you've learned about, you even told me when I was getting frustrated because I was in the muddy middle, you're like, trust your breaks because the pandemic froze my life and a lot of people's lives. You're like, trust this break. But let's talk about time and what you've learned about time.
I think every book has its own destiny and it has its own timeline. It really is like it's a living, breathing entity. And to try to wrangle it is humorous, if not tragic. So I think we do our best as co-creation with our muse. We do our best to put self-imposed deadlines in place, which I'm a huge fan of. I'm a huge fan of getting accountability partners. I myself have a mentor, Betsy Rappaport, who I worship.
Love her.
Right? I love her so much. And so I would say to her, I need to book time with you next month. And I'm going to send you chapter 10 and chapter 11. And because I know her time is so valuable, I was super careful to make those deadlines. And it wasn't always easy and I didn't make them all, but it was so helpful because writing is squirrely. Books are slippery, especially if you're writing a memoir. your life keeps evolving. Your writing gets better as you go. So you finish it and you go, whoa, chapter 1, 2, and 3 aren't as good as chapter 12, 13, 14. Like it's crazy making.
Yeah.
So I think you have to block time out as much as you can, put it on the schedule. I have a blog post on bookmama.com called Going Dark to Write. I just thought of this. It's so helpful for planning like writing retreats for yourself, whether it's a half day or 2 weeks or a month or whatever. So you can search that. But finding the time to write is hard for everybody. And yet it's something none of us can get away from. And there are a million different ways to do it. Some people write only in the morning. Some people like Lee Child, who sold hundreds of millions of books, is like, nothing good ever happens in the morning. I mean, you know, there's no right way to do it, but you got to show up.
You do. And you have to make space. Okay. This one had me laughing out loud. Joel Stein. It's clearly a huge mistake to write in your house. And I feel this way. It's just stupid. If you have kids, if you have anyone, even if you have a refrigerator, it's just a total bad idea to write in your house. That's hysterical.
He's the best. He had a humor column in Time Magazine for a long time. I was such a huge fan. So when I had him on the podcast, I was giddy. I was just giddy.
Yeah. Oh, I bet. So tell me about launching your podcast and getting these incredible names like Tom Hanks to sit down and talk to you. Tell us about that.
You know, Danielle Laporte and I had done your Big Beautiful Book Plan, which is like helps writers navigate the process of selling their work. And we created a group, the Beautiful Writers Group. And I just wanted to have interviews with some of our writing friends because I thought, oh gosh, it'll make it so much easier for them to do this path. And so we had on Martha Beck and Danny Shapiro and Jillian Lauren and a couple people like that. And then one day I just thought, ooh, this should be a podcast. And this was like 7 years ago when not podcasts weren't as well known. And so I kind of like didn't know how hard it would be, just no clue. Like, oh, let's just do a podcast. And I went to a book signing. I was in a green room with Liz Gilbert. We were having a nice catch up. I hadn't seen her in a long time and she was becoming a friend. And I said, you know, I think we're going to do this thing. Would you come on? She said, yes. And so we launched with 6 shows so people could binge listen if they wanted to, which I think was a better idea than starting one at a time and just slowly producing them.
Yeah.
And it just caught on so fast. And it was so exciting. And so then it was kind of easy to get guests. And Danielle and I knew so many authors, right? And we had one guiding rule because we both had so many clients and friends who were writers and we're like, how do we keep people from hating us if we don't have them on the show? So the rule was it had to be New York Times bestsellers on tour. We broke that rule a few times for like spiritual folk or what have you, but it was a really good rule. And so I think we just attracted the best talent. We were so excited. I mean, like when I had Van Jones on, I just thought I could die right now and I'm done. Like, such a hero of mine in the environmental world. When my son and I wrote Generation Green, Van Jones was like a patron saint for us. And to have him on the show, I couldn't even.
There's a couple of things that I have been thinking a lot about. And one of them is memoir. What do you take of the state of memoir right now?
Oh gosh, that's such a good question. I think that my thinking about it is kind of the same as my mentor's thinking, which is memoir is hard to sell. There's got to be something really fresh or unique or different about your angle if you're not famous. And as soon as your memoir comes out and you're an unknown who goes, you know, into the stratosphere, then everybody will want to copy you. You know, it's just a matter of, I don't know if it's destiny. I don't know if it's karma. I don't know why some people get published and some people don't always. Like sometimes it really is truly a mystery. And again, my sister, the astrologer, would say, oh, it's so obvious. You know, Venus is in their 9th house right now of publishing and they're in a benevolent period. I mean, I don't know, but I do know that memoir is one of the most beloved categories of books. I'm always listening and reading a memoir, always, as I know you are.
Yep.
And a lot of people are like us. So there is a never-ending desire for and need for memoir.
Yeah.
The trick is writing one that's a page turner so that it will be purchased.
Yeah.
That's hard for everybody, including the famous memoirists.
Right. That's such a good point. And then there's this fascinating, well, I think celebrity, I like to say, has hijacked it in some way, but it's so much easier for them to get a book deal. And not all of those have worked out. So the publishing houses are getting nervous, is my understanding. But yeah. You also have this fascinating angle where you were a ghostwriter. And I just think that is, it's like you're Batman. It's like a superpower. Tell us about ghostwriting and what that experience was like.
It's so hard and so fun and so traumatic all at the same time.
I would think so.
First of all, it's a lot of pressure because the person who's hiring you to write their life story is paying you a good amount of money, but they're saying, I'm going to give you this money, but you better give me a New York Times bestseller. I mean, that's really what they're hoping for, right? Nobody wants to hire somebody to write a book that nobody reads. So it's very scary. I did it really well a couple of times. A couple of the books I ghostwrote hit the New York Times. Sometimes my name was attached. Sometimes it was just in the acknowledgement section. In every case, I always felt like I couldn't do it. Like I was super excited to get the job, to promote myself for the job, to try out for the job, to land the job. Then I'm always super excited at the beginning. You take your tape recorder and you go interview that person for endless hours and you read everything that they've written and you go to their speeches and you go to their home and you're an actor playing a role, right? You're getting into character. I love the process of getting into character. And then you're sitting alone with your computer and you have to send them chapter 1 and 2 and 3, maybe. You know, you don't want to send just one chapter. You want to send a couple of, just so they get into the flow. And you're sitting there going, oh my God, like this is shit. I'm sure it's shit. And I had a rule, no panic. Cause I always knew my first draft was going to be shit. I always knew they weren't going to love the first draft. That once they gave me their notes, that I would be able to craft something they loved. And then I had another rule, which is until I got an email that said, oh my God, it's fucking brilliant. Like literally those had to be the words. Oh my God, it's fucking brilliant, that I hadn't nailed it. And I have kept the emails that say, oh my God, it's fucking brilliant. Like I have them from 3 people that I can think of right now. 2 of the books were New York Times bestsellers and 1 of the books helped launch an Emmy career. But to get there is so hard.
So hard.
You know everything, right? Your ass falls because you're not exercising. Your hair's unwashed. Your kids are running wreck shot. Your husband wants to leave because he's so ignored. Like it is no joke. It is no joke playing at that level. I'll never do it again. Once I got finished with that part of my life, I was like, so glad I did it because it taught me so much to write for women and men at the same time. So half the day you're writing for a man, the other half of the day you're writing in a woman's voice, but you're getting paid really well. Yeah. Family's taken care of, even though they're angry at you for being absent.
They can eat, but they hate you. It's right. Fine.
You know, your health is deteriorating. You're not losing your house, right? But I will never, ever do it again. In fact, a huge celebrity called me recently. Will you write my memoir? And I was like, what a chance. Thanks so much. Like Oprah could call me and I would say, I love you, Oprah. I would die to sit with you every day, but no, thank you. Couldn't do it.
How long does it normally take? I'm fascinated by this role. How long does it take?
Well, it depends on the deadline. So I wrote a book called The Compound Effect with Darren Hardy, and it was a big business book. It's still a big business book. It's like 10 year anniversary, and it's still selling so well. And Darren and I collaborated on that book, and it was fast because he had a fast timeline in his head when he hired me. And so when we got together, we just outlined, okay, in 10 weeks, here's what I'm going to deliver. You know, chapters 2 and 3, you just boom, 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 and you just knock it out. And with him, he was very hands-on. I'd send him a chapter, he'd send it back. So you're always working on the new stuff, but also cleaning up the old stuff. But it was fast. I don't know, 12 weeks, 16
Wow.
weeks. It wasn't that long. But oh my gosh. Then other books with writing the proposal first, selling the proposal. Meanwhile, you're still interviewing them, you're still getting to know them. It could take a year from start to finish. So it just depends. Every book is different. Every book pays differently, depending on how much the author has and how much the writer needs, how desperate the writer is, how desperate the author is. I mean, it's just, we could talk forever about that.
Oh yeah. I find it fascinating. And you did have an unfortunate experience. One that was where you wrote the memoir for him and then some bad things happened. And that was really hard for you too.
That was really, really hard. Yeah. I wrote a book called Harmonic Wealth with James Arthur Ray.
Yeah.
And it was a great book and it hit the lists and my name was on it. That it was just fabulous. A couple years later, he was leading a sweat lodge where three people died and he was sent to prison.
Yeah.
And it was devastating. I mean, devastating for him too. Devastating for everybody involved. Fortunately for me, the book had been out a couple of years. So while the press did find me and ask me questions, they understood when I said, guys, I'm out.
Like, this is
too sad and too intense. And I had no awareness of what he was dealing with when that happened. I mean, I certainly talked to him before he went to prison, but
yeah.
That was really, really sad. And just like with Mark Manson, who wrote the Will Smith memoir, you love the people that you collaborate with. And it doesn't matter if they are high maintenance, because guess what? Almost everybody writing a book is high maintenance. It doesn't matter anything that goes down. You could probably hate your co-author by the time they get into trouble. But as soon as somebody that you've worked that closely with goes through a trauma like that, where especially in Mark's in my case, our authors were publicly hated globally.
Yes.
That is a particular kind of pain that you identify with. Like, you have empathy for this person because you were in their skin while you were writing. You were in their body, in their consciousness when you were writing for them.
Right.
A really weird scenario.
Really weird. And I found that episode with you and Mark so fascinating because, you know, the Will Smith thing where he was like, why was anybody surprised? Because he had zipped himself in his skin and he's like, that's West Philly Will.
West Philly Will showing up. I know, right?
Right. And so, yeah, it was just kind of a fascinating kind of reveal. And I just find that whole idea of, well, memoir is hard enough. And then doing someone else's memoir and zipping yourself in their skin, that's a fascinating experience. How do you become a good writer?
I think it starts with a desire. I always say, if you have the ache, you have what it takes. So trust that. You know, people try to come to my writing retreats and send me like lots of samples ahead of time to prove to me that they're worthy, that they can do it, that I'll be able to help them get an agent down the road and a deal. And I just say, stop. Like, if you have the ache, I'm not worried about it. If your writing isn't strong enough and you don't want to take the time to get it there with all the different ideas I have about how to help you, we'll find you a ghostwriter. We'll find you an editor. Don't stress. Like, what I need to see in somebody is the ache and the desire and the story. After that, there's a million different ways to become a beautiful writer. Now, if you really can't string sentences together, can you become Liz Gilbert? No, I'm sorry. There is a certain level of creative elegance that I think we're just born with. I did have it. I was the Cyrano de Bergerac for my girlfriends in high school, writing their love letters for the guys. I always knew I could write.
Yeah.
But what I didn't have under my belt was the schooling. I didn't know punctuation. And I didn't spell very well. I could hear the rhythm of a story. I could tell a story, but I needed a lot of craft. And so that I learned from books. I mean, I was so driven. I read Strunk and White, The Elements of Style. I read the Chicago Manual of Style. I mean, this huge like encyclopedic book on grammar and punctuation. I read that thing like it was Penthouse. I mean, I was just obsessed. That book. And I think when you are driven for a goal and you don't have any money. I didn't have any extra money. It wasn't like I could go hire somebody to teach me how to be good at this. And I was kicking myself. I hadn't paid more attention in English. I was always late to English because it was first class. And I was messing with my frizzy ass hair every morning. There was no way I was going to pay attention in English. So you can learn everything you need to know from the greats. They tell you, YouTube University. I mean, it's all out there, but you have to put your ass in the chair or the earbuds in the ears, and you have to want to learn,
but you have to have the ache. Yeah. And I think that's true in most creative things, wouldn't you say, but especially in writing, you have to have the thing that keeps you going because it takes so incredibly long.
Yeah, it's so solitary, and the people around you don't love it that you're being so boring.
Right. Tom Hanks had some really great things to say in the book too, that it's all about voice, 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 voice. Can you make voice? Can you learn voice? Or is it just in you? What do you think?
You have to listen to your voice and tape yourself. A lot of people get really intimidated by the page. So they learned all these things in English about don't use contractions, and their writing is stilted. It's boring. Mm-hmm. But so they think they're not good. But if you ask them a story, they can get really fun and conversational. So what I started doing years and years ago when I started was I started taping myself on phone calls because I thought, how do I sound? I needed to know how I sounded. And what I found was, whoa, I was too casual. I used way too many swear words. I said, far too often. So I think by taping yourself, you learn a lot about your voice and what you like about it and what you don't like about it.
I love that.
As far as being unique and specific to you, as opposed to trying to sound like somebody else, listen for where your voice is unique. And if it's not unique enough, learn some words, go traveling, you know, take yourself into different situations so you have more to say. You have stories that are entertaining. A lot of people, they're like, huh, like Laura Munson in the book, she was like MFA or travel the world. Mm-hmm. I think I'll travel. I think I'll do the Hard Knocks way and get some stories from just flinging myself out into the world.
Like Liz Gilbert, totally. Just go out there and life will give you a voice in some ways, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. I have a technology sales background. So it is ingrained in me that no's and rejection are means that you're doing something and you're striving forward, but I don't think everybody else feels that way. And Seth Godin, he had 800 rejections, I think it was, in 1 year. So let's talk about rejection and your take on it and what you learned from some of these greats and rejection yourself.
I think my favorite quote that my sister just drilled into my head, she didn't make it up, obviously, but it's that rejection is God's protection.
Oh, that's right.
I really, really believe that because what I've seen with myself and with my clients over the years is that rejection never feels good. It always hurts. We always hate it. And later on, it always makes sense. Later on, you're like, thank God that book isn't out there traipsing its storylines around the world because I'm now so much better, or I'm now so much more connected and can make so much more forward movement with my book. Like there are so many, so many, so many reasons why people call me later and go, thank God. Mm-hmm. Thank God. And so you just, when you're in that rejection period, you just have to trust. And it sucks. And it's hard. And I'm sorry.
And I'm sorry, but rejection is God's protection. I mean, that's the best.
Keep focusing on your craft. That's what I did as I was getting rejected. How can I make myself better? How can I magnetize people to this project? How can I pay attention to the universe's good, orderly direction for me?
Yeah.
Ask yourself empowering questions.
So even though it's hard, do you love what you do?
I love it. I love it. I'm obsessed with it. My son said that to me yesterday. He said, Mom, you are absolutely obsessed with books. I said, I know. Isn't it the weirdest thing?
And here you're birthing your own books, but you're also helping people birth theirs. What is that like to see somebody that you've mentored or coached hold it in their hands?
God. It's so interesting that you asked that. I was just interviewing somebody, Dr. Jody Carrington, who is on book tour right now for her amazing book called Feeling Seen. And I had forgotten that how much I had helped her at the beginning. I didn't even really remember. And the reason I was interviewing her was because I thought, I need to do a show on self-publishing. All of the Beautiful Writers podcast episodes have been with these huge, you know, traditionally published stars, but it's like, wait a minute. We have this whole untapped listenership of people who are going to self-publish. What can I offer to those people? Yeah. And so I called Hal Elrod, who had sold a book called Miracle Morning, and he sold 3 million of those, and that was self-published. So he's made many, many, many millions of dollars.
I love that book. Love it.
I love that book. So he's such a dear client. So I called Hal and asked him if he wanted to be on. And then I called Dr. Jody. She self-published her first one. We worked on that on a retreat. And that little self-published book called Kids These Days has sold 250,000 books. And now, just like Hal, she is traditionally published, right? Now yeah. She's on a huge book tour for, I forget, Random House, I think. Putnam or Random House are actually, they're together now. It's just magic for me when I see people who came to me before they had ever published anything.
Yeah.
There's so many people. I just think, how did I get so lucky? Like, you know how I got lucky? Because I trusted what I knew in my gut, which was it didn't matter that I didn't have a college degree. It didn't matter that I wasn't a PhD. Was I ashamed of those things early on? A little, but I was like, you know what? Fuck it. That doesn't mean I don't have like some kind of innate intelligence that maybe they don't have. Maybe my intelligence is intuitive. Maybe the mystical sort of spirit connection I have to books is enough to help propel people's destiny. And I just freaking trusted. And I'm so glad that I'm naive and grandiose enough to have done that because it's worked out.
It has. That's it right there. I mean, trusting your gut and believing in yourself. Yeah. I think we get too hung up on titles and degrees and things like that. And they are all important, of course.
Usually.
But sometimes it's just believing and manifesting and visualizing that is what you need. You're yeah. such an awesome person.
Oh, baby.
You are. I feel like I just went to a lecture or to some like to church of some kind. Book church.
The book church. Church.
I went to book church.
I want to go to book church.
Oh, so amazing. And all the work that you're doing for horses and everything too, and your love for Mother Earth. With good Lord, she needs us, doesn't she?
Oh man. What the F?
I don't know.
The only way that I can not jump off a cliff is to just keep trying to help what's right in front of me. So those wild horses, hashtag Alpine Wild Horse Army, if you're interested, those horses are right in front of me. They're in the mountains where I live. They're being rounded up by the government. They're being sold in auctions to kill buyers who drive them to Mexico and slaughter them.
Ugh.
So publishing takes a long time. Writing takes forever. But saving a horse can be 2 days. There's an auction tomorrow. So it's like, it's just so in my bones. It's so my passion now.
Yeah. And I'm with you. I mean, if you read the news too much, or you just see what we're doing to our planet, or these sweet, sweet animals who, I mean, these wild horses are a symbol of America itself and how it started. I don't understand.
Built America on their backs.
On their backs. I don't understand how our government could dismiss them in such a way. However, I think it's such good advice. Do what you can with what's right in front of you, because if you try and take it all in, it's just going to drag you down, right? It's
depressing. And then for the people that are doing it on a bigger scale, mm-hmm. you know, you give them your money. So like I give Glennon Doyle's Together Rising every month because I also want to be helping in Turkey and Syria.
Right.
But I know if left to my own devices, I'm not going to be helping them. So I give the money to the people who are helping them, and then I can help the horses that are right in my backyard.
One last thing. So a lot of people fear that books are going to go away, you know, because the publishing industry is changing and people are like, oh, you know, are they even going to exist? Mm-hmm. I have my belief, but I want to ask you first on the future of books.
I think that I am the wrong person to ask because I'm so in love with books, right? So it's right. Like, I can't imagine living in a world without books. I wouldn't even want to live in a world without books. So I personally believe that they are going to be harder and harder to publish traditionally, right? As the traditional publishers keep eating each other and there's less and less potential space for talent, it will get harder and harder to be one of those lucky few at the top. But self-publishing, millions of people are doing it. I can't imagine life without stories. We learn through stories. Stories are coded in our DNA. They inform how we move through the world. Those aren't going anywhere. So I just have a lot of optimism that books are forever, at least as long as we're here as people. So I don't worry about it.
I don't either.
I do, you know, really work hard to publish on sustainable paper for a stewardship council paper. I'm very aware that publishing, like lots of big industries, is toxic. And so the more that we can lean towards sustainability, the better I feel about it.
Oh, that's awesome. Linda, you just do you in the most magical way. I love you so much. You're such an inspiration. And I'm so happy that I signed up for your retreat 4 years ago.
Oh my gosh. I'm so happy that you did. It was absolutely delightful.
Don't you just feel better about the world listening to Linda? To me, she's magic, a fairy sprinkling dust to ensure your dreams bloom. She knows how to listen to the universe and encourages you to follow your heart. What I find remarkable about Linda is that she never took the straight path, but forged one on her own, one of authenticity, of grit, of manifestation. Those lessons transfer over to anything you wish to pursue. Hers is a story of making it and achieving her dreams, then opening the door to others to share their own tales. In the end, no matter who you are, celebrity or not, it all takes work, but first, you must dream. Until next time, stay curious and be well.